in the studios in Granbury, and you are seeing only the very first episode of Lead the Narrative. It's a new program. We're just launching it. We're going to have some great interviews. See, here's what I realized. I'm an expert at only a couple of things. A real expert at really only one, because I've spent most of my life studying, and that is communication. And when I say an expert in communication, what I mean is I've studied some of the best in the world and how they deliver a message. I've also studied how they research a message, how they develop a message. Where do the ideas come from? Why do they carry that message forward into the world? And what impact does that message have? Some of my favorites are Winston Churchill, John Maxwell, Robert Schuller, probably some of the communicators that you've studied through the course of your life as well. But I read just about everybody. I study just about everybody who's ever taken a platform, ever grabbed a microphone, ever picked up a pen, because I know that the way they communicate and the things they communicate shape the culture that we live in and the world we're surrounded by. That means to me that what they have to say is important. Whether I like it or not, doesn't matter. Whether I agree or not, doesn't matter. The fact that they have the ability to communicate and a platform from which to communicate means they are, by definition, leading the narrative. I've also come under the conviction in the last couple of years that I've been doing Leading Leaders podcast for 8 years now, that there's a whole lot of narrative out there that has been pre-planned for decades, some of it centuries. There are communities of people who have been intentionally lied to, misled, and information hidden from them. There are entire nations who don't know the truth about the rest of the world because someone has been very busy leading the narrative. And I feel like my assignment in 2023 is to help to craft a new narrative, to not just be a part of, be aware of, be an acknowledgement that there is a narrative, but to help to craft a new narrative that will lead generations and cultures, perhaps for centuries to come. I think it's time, and I think there are people who have great ideas that I'm not even privy to. I'm not an expert in world finance. I'm not an expert in world politics. I'm not an expert in any of those things. I studied them enough to know that there are some intelligent questions that are not being asked. And that is my job here on Lead the Narrative, to ask those tough, difficult questions. And you know what? Sometimes it ruffles people's feathers. Sometimes within their community, they are the expert and they are the genius and they can never be questioned. Fauci. But the reality is that they're not always right. And their narrative goes forward anyway. So in this program, Lead the Narrative, I will challenge those people who have great intellect and great influence and great platforms and great insights. Some that I agree with and some that I disagree with. And I'm okay with that, because I think what's more important than anything else is that we have an intelligent, open dialogue and that we have the conversation. To bring all that to bear on my own convictions, I have a group of friends in the studio and some in that are joining us virtually that we're going to talk today about a new organization called the Media Liberty Alliance. The Media Liberty Alliance is a group that we've joined. And the purpose of that group is to, well, lead the narrative, to get back to the purpose of these core values that we all share, realizing we don't all have everything in common. But we have some things in common that are so important that when we let them go, the world changes. And we have platforms, and we have relationships, and we have expertises that together we can lead the narrative and change the world. So I'm going to introduce you to my friends from the OBDM Network and the publisher of the Atneys magazine. We're going to talk about what it means to publish a magazine in this world when all the articles come from the worldview of veterans. We're going to talk about what it means to distribute media from many different worldviews and many different ideologies on many different platforms, television, satellite, terrestrial broadcast, as well as OTT, because we know that landscape is changing. Fox News, CNN, anybody? Are you paying attention at all to the way that media is being controlled? These voices, like this, you may find us standing on soapboxes in town square soon, but if you're not a strong communicator, if you haven't gotten back to your core values, if you don't know what's important to you, well, you might as well not have a First Amendment. So I wanted to help you welcome my in-studio guests, Larry and Susan, and then virtually we also have Christine. So I'm going to start with you, Susan.
Oh, wow. Hi.
Tell us why you're here and what this is about for you.
Well, I couldn't wait to see your studio here, and I'm really excited about the work we've been doing with the Media Liberty Alliance. And I thought it was important with the Lead the Narrative TV to help people understand, I agree with you, it's time to start shaping our world. After all, isn't that what this other narrative is trying to do? And I think we can see the detriment of that. When I first started conceptualizing, you know, what can we do, how can we do a better job when the word veteran or patriot or pro-life are considered dirty words or terrorist types of words, what's that going to do when we've been taught to build our communities online? And now those, if you mention those types of things, now that can be censored, stopped, your money can be cut off. And I started realizing we needed to have a smarter way for us to be able to craft exposure for brands and have them have messages that really do reflect our American values, our family values, and start promoting the things that are right. Because at the end of the day, this nation needs to be handed down to my grandkids and beyond, right?
Absolutely. Larry, what are your thoughts on Lead the Narrative?
Well, I was going to ask you, you're a wordsmith by nature. What is your, if you had to describe what you mean by narrative, what do you mean someone, because we hear this often, right, in newscasts that we watch on TV, pundits, they always talk about the narrative. What do you say when you say the narrative? What do you mean?
So I acknowledge that there is an agenda. Generally an agenda. Now, I can take this to a business application because a lot of people miss the relevance. If you've got a vision statement for your organization, if you've got a mission statement, if you know what it is that you want to talk about, you know where it is that your business is going to arrive, that is a driving narrative. We will serve XYZ kind of a people, we'll provide XYZ kind of a product, we'll do it at this price point in this geography. That's a narrative. And so every marketing message, every sales message, every approach, every organization that you go after, they've got to be a part of that narrative. If you're not talking to them or talking about them, then you're ignoring them. And when you're doing that, you're changing the narrative, which is going to impact your product. From a more macro narrative standpoint, here's an example. Maybe you've heard the old phrase, children should be seen and not heard. That's even been manipulated a little bit to say children should be seen and not hurt. Maybe you've heard narratives like the woman's place is in the kitchen, the man's place is at work. Now, it's ironic that we think about those phrases and some immediately think sexism and racism and judgment, et cetera, et cetera. We ask questions like, why do our welfare laws make it more affordable for a single mother to raise children receiving welfare than for a man to stay in the home and try to earn enough income to cover the gap? We have policies that have been in place for that. And so the narrative changed to, we need to have a two-household income. Everybody needs to have two people in the home earning. Well, we created ad campaigns. We've created desire and demand in the world of consumerism to create that reality. Well, what was the real purpose of that reality? Some will tell you it was about taxation. We need to have two earners so we can tax them both. So when I talk about narrative, I talk about the overall long-range plans, the grand visions and the grand designs for our societies and our cultures that some had been crafted from the very beginning. I had a great conversation with a guy that in his 20s was part of a city council. And he told me that city council had a 100-year plan. A what? Yep. A city council with a 100-year plan. They talked about what monuments will be in the town square. What things will we discuss? What policies will we have? I just moved recently to this little community, Granbury, and I was talking to a guy the other day, and he said, yeah, 100 plus years ago when the city of Granbury was founded, some of the very first communities that were built here were just little housing additions. And when the developer built them, they wrote into the bylaws of the title deeds that they could never be annexed by the city. Some of those communities exist within a mile of what is now the historic downtown square of Granbury. And yet they are not part of the city of Granbury. Because over 100 years ago, somebody said, we will not be controlled by city politics. That's forward thinking. That's a narrative.
I think that's important for us. The reason I ask is because I think a lot of people in our audience don't spend a lot of time thinking about this big question that we're about to try and talk about. That this why is our current administration allowing people to come across the border? Why would they want to do that? Well, they actually have a reason for doing that. I was watching a newscast this morning, and it had the Attorney General from the state of Florida, and she actually sued the Biden administration, and they're trying to accomplish something that nobody else has had any success doing regarding Title 42. But there, one thing that she said was, if you get in deep to what is happening at the border, the only conclusion that you can come to is that it is a controlled thought process that they're allowing people to come through the border. So now we have to take the stance when we in the general public, we talk about why would they want to dilute our population, test our resources, all these kinds of things, is because it's part of their narrative, right? They actually have a goal in mind that is a nefarious one, actually. It's something that we don't like to think about, but there are people in control that have a grander vision that sadly doesn't include the United States Constitution of the United States as we now see it and as we out know it. They want this to be ruled at another level, a global level. They want us to be part of a larger entity. And until you can wrap your head around that and look at all these things, and it's such a, someone once said we're fighting a 30-front war. It's more than that. It's everything that permeates our society today. Until you can wrap your head around that there is a central theme that's going on here and there's a central reason why it's happening, once you do that, then a lot of these things start to make sense.
Yeah.
So when we say we want to lead the narrative currently is a global one. They have a global destination. It is a narrative that encompasses everything from your local community, like that 100-year plan, all the way up to our federal government and beyond. It involves all the corporations. It involves all our assembly people and all our little rules and little HOAs. Everything that you can think of all is encompassed. It's huge. And until you can wrap your head around that, we want to redirect that narrative to something that more aligns with what we began as a country, why we began as a country, getting back to the rights and privileges of an individual and falling under our constitutional laws and bylaws. So what we thought to do here was, number one, define the narrative for us. What is the narrative that we're going to try and lead from? And then how can we gather the troops on our side, the people that are all trying to do that in their way? How can we combine forces in one way in order to kind of focus on a general direction that we want to shoot towards?
I agree with that 100%. And I think one of the challenges that we face as a society, as an organization, even as a nation, is what is the narrative that we can all agree on? I think that all by itself is a challenge because we have for 200 plus years been a melting pot of ideologies and theories and theologies and cultures and societies. I think there are some core values, maybe the Bill of Rights, that we can start with as a really good launching point. But I think we've got to spend a whole lot of time discussing openly what are these issues that we're addressing and how do we make them as equitable as possible.
That's interesting.
Use a popular word.
It is, because and as you and Christine both coming to us as veterans, right? You've got there's a whole lot of our population that really needs to be heard. And the leadership that comes from that is really important. And I'm not sure if we do not take a stand and do a better job of communication, that I'm not sure we're going to be able to stay connected as we need to, as a fabric of our nation. It's vital.
You know, I can't take credit for it. I can't remember which social media that I saw it on, but it was a gentleman who showed up late for work, probably the third or fourth day in a row, and his boss confronted him and said, you know, we don't ask much from you as a greeter here at Walmart, but we do expect you to be on time. We do expect you to be courteous and respectful. And I just have to ask, as your boss, if you showed up 3 days in a row late at your last job, how would people have reacted to you? What would they have said to you? He said, well, normally they would say, good morning, General. Can I get your coffee? And there's such a profound reality to that, but we forget sometimes that, you know, we see it right here in Granbury. We've got retired generals in town, and you see them sitting around in the coffee shop, and they're just, you know, chatting it up. It's a little bit of nothing. But you forget the wisdom that is carried within their soul, the experiences they've had, the things that they've seen, the places they've been. And if we destroy that heritage, that history. If we abandon that knowledge, we lose a lot. I met just briefly with a guy this morning who is one of the members of the local chapter of the Sons of the Republic of Texas. And he told me just what it takes just to be a member of that organization. But then he told me he's written over 30 books, and it's all about the history of Texas as a nation on its own, and how young people today don't know that there ever was such a thing. That, my friends, is a narrative. Christine, tell us a little bit about Addie's Magazine and why you do what you do.
Okay, so Addie's Veterans Magazine is an independent. Make that very clear. We are an independent veterans magazine, 100% written by vets, for vets. And it exists to give veterans a voice in their own words, in their own purview. And so that's why we exist. It's just a very simple premise, but the veteran community is a thriving, vibrant community, and there's a lot going on, good and some not so good stuff, but for the most part, we are a thriving community, and our vets have a lot of knowledge and understanding and expertise, and to write articles that are educational or informative or historical, or even just sharing their own stories and what they themselves have been through during their time in service and what they've done since. So that's why we exist.
So let me ask the question kind of the crowd, and we'll go around to answer it. When you think about just phrases that we all grew up with, like listen to your parents, father knows best, how do you think those statements, just those two, how do you think those would be received in the public school system today, or even in the playground conversation among our elementary age kids? Susan?
Oh, well, it's very clear that parents are, I would use the word marginalized. I never thought I'd use that word, but that's probably a great way to put it, because just on the overall, I think parents need to stand up for their role in the child's life, because what we have right now is a government that thinks that the children belong to them. I think that's a problem, and a lot of people think that's a problem. But how to have that conversation is really important. Because we can do a better job, and it makes me think of one of the podcasts on our network that you and me and the ISD, that's the whole reason that he works so hard to help us see, look, there's got to be a communication piece here. We got to do a better job of putting together how do you work. First of all, we don't know how the whole dang thing works. That's a big part of it, wouldn't you say? How does it work? How does the school district work? How does it work within the school? And if you understand that, then you can work within it a little bit better, and you can decide what you like and what you don't like. You certainly can't do that if it's just based on the narrative, right? It's just what they tell us. This group of eight, I think all of us need to be very concerned about the idea that a board comes together, or whatever board or council, and says, here's what we think, and this is what we're going to now present to you in a marketing fashion, that this is how it is. Okay, parents and community, this is what we're providing for you. They say they're listening to us, but you've got a few minutes, and we're going to turn off that mic, and it better be agreeable, right? So I'm not sure that the parents are respected as they should be throughout. And so I don't know. I would say that I'm concerned for our next generation if they're taught to foster a disrespect in a way of the parents that, you know, hey, we've got, don't tell your parents about this particular class or about this particular project or this particular closet. Don't tell them about these books, or don't have this conversation, but you can trust us, student. We're the school for you. We'll teach you. We'll help you. We'll be there for you. You can talk to us about anything.
And we're even okay to not only accept the lies that you tell your parents, but to help you lie to your parents.
Yeah, then we'll even hide it for you. Yeah. So
I was going to say, I don't even know if it's. I mean, that's one aspect of the question that you asked, but also within the home itself.
Yeah.
I don't think the parents are. We have a large contingency of parents that don't want to accept it or don't feel they have either the knowledge, the experience, the ability to raise their child. They are not opposed to getting help. Hillary Clinton formed the phrase, it takes a village, right? It takes a village. It started many years ago, and I think it's been ingrained in parents, particularly certain sets of parents in certain geographical locations, that they are not prepared to deal with kids, and that it's better if someone that's more intelligent, more able to handle those problems than you in the home, that's not your areas of expertise, let us do a better job. And there's a huge segment of the population out there that is more than willing to let their kids be managed and run by somebody else. So I don't think the father knows best, you know, category fits in most homes in America anymore. I think it's sad, but we talk about the narrative. I think it's been ingrained in them so hard that there are better equipped people to handle those kids' problems, that they're now willing to let them go. How else can we explain the fact that they're allowing a child that's 7 or 8 to be exposed to not only graphic material, but also sex change information and physical interference at 8, 9, 10, 11?
You know, but I'll say that part of that is when we were taking this beautiful drive over here to Granbury, and we were talking about the fact that even as parents, sometimes us not looking. I think a lot of times, really, the state of things the way they are today, we're guilty of the apathy of just not looking, and it only takes one generation. And we've seen that pain, and we've seen that struggle. It only takes a very short period of time to not look and allow something else just to kind of take that spot. Because it is exhausting today. Let's just say it is. And if we can have somebody else, it does make sense, right? To state-sponsor school. Well, guess what? That's government school. Let's let the kids go to government school. It's easier, and the longer that day gets, well, that just means I can work longer. Our value system is a little skewed because we haven't thought of there being a narrative and a lifestyle that's really kind of been handed to us and said, here's a life for you. It should look like this. And this is probably what it's going to look like in these frameworks. I don't think that we take enough initiative. And I would say, Christine, that's probably one of the things I liked most about your magazine. I love it. Love it, love it, love it. Because you've got these guys, they're really talking about not necessarily that particular issue, but that particular, that there's a way to look at life as though we have to decide. We have to determine, and here's a better way. Here's my experience. And here's where we go, which I think is a lot of what you bring to the table, Lauren.
You know, one of the things we don't do is, you know, we don't view masculinity as toxic. One, you know, my brothers in arms, whether they, regardless of which branch they served in, you know, there's a phenomenal amount of respect that we have for each other within the veteran community. And it doesn't matter if you're male or female, but the reality is, you know, I personally, I have so much incredible respect for my brothers.
Yeah.
And I think that comes down to there's been an ongoing narrative, again, over the last few years that is denigrating men, denigrating fatherhood, denigrating masculinity, denigrating the God-given purpose of men. And I think, you know, one thing that we do is, quite frankly, not only don't we deal with it, we just don't buy into it. For us, we're just like, okay, that's what you say. And we just go and do our own thing.
It seems to me fascinating, too, not just from the educational system and the impact that they have on our children, the decisions that they're making, what they find prioritized or not. But there's also a lot of shrouded intent. There's a whole lot of, we're not going to tell you what we're up to. You just need to accept it. Like you said, that committee of 8, they get to make the decisions. They get to tell the rest of us how that's going to be. And you're going to kind of live with it. We've heard recently phrases like, by 2030, you'll own nothing and you'll be happy. I remember my mother saying when we were kids, you'll get what you get and you won't throw a fit. And I always thought, well, what if I do throw a fit? What if I don't like what I get? What if that really upsets me? And it seemed to me that I don't care. Your opinion doesn't matter. So, you know, tell me what you feel. Tell me what you think. Yay, you go. In fact, she used to say this. You got the same pants to get glad in that you got mad in. And I never understood that phrase.
But I'm going to use it. I'm going to start using it. I love it. I love it. I love it. It's interesting what you said when you talked about this is an agenda 2030. And that's what we need to understand. That's why the culmination and why the acceleration. This has happened a long time ago. As a matter of fact, on our obvmdfw.locals.com channel, I've actually been talking about this and sharing content where you can see your city may have signed up for this. I know in my city, we signed up in 2004. At that time, as you said, some of these plans go back 100 years. Guess what? Those things matter. And if we're not paying attention, we don't understand what some of the phrases mean because they sound really good. The idea is sold to us. It's actually sold to us through a marketing company that teaches cities how to sell their idea to us. And so this narrative idea goes way back. And it, the issue is, however, that it's not about all the things they sold it to us about a long time ago. It's not about freedom. It's about how do we control absolutely every aspect of your life, from your children to your health to your money to the circumference that you're allowed to move about in. And what we need to understand is a 15-minute city roll out across the globe. In America, Cleveland is set to be the very first city here. Richardson's not, Texas isn't far from it. We've got the core district. We need to understand that's, that means more than you realize it means, because the idea of a 15-minute city, these things where they already exist, they're being resisted. It means that they're going to tell you there's a certain flow throughout the community that you're allowed to go. And it's going to be completely surveilled. If you don't think that can happen, that happens in Hong Kong, that happens in Toronto. So these things already exist. Your North Central Texas Council of Governments right here actually is about, and the way they employ this is the emergency ability to move between counties, and that makes perfect sense, doesn't it? But have you asked yourself, when they took down the red, when they ended the red light camera law, why did we get more cameras? And you understand, I walked around and put door hangers out for my candidate that I was getting behind the other day. Everybody has Ring on their doorbell. Everybody, that's completely triangulated by your phone. There is, at this stage, all you have to do, it is very, very nominal to employ what needs to be employed. The only way they can do this, however, is with the buy-in. That's the buy-in. It's our agreement. They're not going to tell you, we want to completely control you. That's not how things are today. This narrative is much deeper than, I just want you to think a certain way. We're going to roll out an idea.
We just witnessed the largest experiment the world's ever known through this pandemic, right? So we had this, whatever that ailment was, that, and I contracted it. It wasn't fun. It was a bad thing that knocked me out for several weeks. I had one of the worst cases, but I did survive that, and I did get natural immunity. And we at the network have had the good fortune of talking to a lot of people in the medical fields that were at the forefront of the COVID-19 issue and what it was and what it wasn't.
Right.
And we were also at the forefront of the vaccine issue, what it was and what it wasn't. And we knew right off it wasn't about the masks. It wasn't about 6 feet of distance. We knew that was a made-up number that they just made up in the White House purely out of thin air. It's not 10, it's not 4, 6 sounds good. So they just came up with a lot of contrived. But the whole thing was about control.
Yeah.
And the way to signify that you were under control was, if we could see that you were wearing a mask, you passed, right? We understood that you were following the narrative. And that was done on a global level. They declared a global pandemic emergency that they could control every nation and every person in the globe. And now our dear administration has just signed a treaty that allows the WHO, the World Health Organization,
United Nations organization,
to declare the next global pandemic in any way, shape, or form they see fit. And we have subverted, we are now submitting our allegiance to this global group that they can dictate what's going to occur in the United States of America. And we've willingly done that. We have willingly passed along, whether you know it or not, your government has already done that. And now they will dictate on a global level whether or not your retail store opens or closes the next time the WHO decides it's going to open or close.
I saw a great Facebook meme the other day, and I don't know if it was Babylon Bee or somebody similar to that, but the guy had his phone in his hand and he walked out the door, and he had a chime on his phone and he was on FaceTime with somebody else. He's like, hang on a second. And he looks down at his phone and it says, you've been deducted $40. And he's like, what? And he starts walking on the sidewalk and says, you've been deducted $80. And he's like, hang on a minute. He turns around and goes back in the house like he's going to check on something else. And as soon as he crosses the threshold of his house, it says, you've been given $80. He's like, wait a minute. So he starts out the door again and says, you've been deducted $10. And for every step that he took, it was taking more money out of his account. And he finally said to whoever he was talking to on his FaceTime, he said, you know, I don't think I'm going to make it today. And when we talk about a digital currency and the ability to tie that, I mean, we already have convenience stores in the United States where you can walk in the door and they take the RFID from your Apple Pay right off your phone when you walk in the door. And you walk around and do whatever shopping you want to. When you walk out the door, it deducts that amount of money for your account. Now, if you don't think that the changing of the laws all over the country that happened during the riots of the pandemic were a direct correlation to training the behavioral habit of people, that you can't even have a security guard stop someone who's shoplifting. And if you do stop them, you might be charged with impeding them or kidnapping, even if they're running out the door with several hundred dollars worth of merchandise. In fact, they proposed the law in Dallas County that they already had in Redwood, California, that it's shoplifting under a value of $600 is not even prosecutable.
Well, under $750, yes, and you're absolutely right about that. In Dallas, by the way, the city of Dallas, if you wonder why the board trustees, when they that talk about these underserved and underprivileged areas, are doing something consistently, the Dallas Express brings this out and really highlights those board trustees that are not doing anything since 2018, but yet this is the group they're going to help. Well, geez, don't you think you'd have made a difference by now? But the reason that Dallas is behaving like Dallas has been signed on to this actively, the mayor's signed on to this actively, right? So we have got the sustainable development goals already being employed. Now, on the outside, talk about a narrative. The outside of that, those sustainable development goals, they sound really good and they're sold to us through using marketing language. If you look at this closer and you actually download the document and understand what it's going to take to do all that, you are made of carbon, you know, and we want a lot less carbon, way too much carbon. You're the carbon. You've got, and they don't care because we're just in the way. The idea is very much the Hunger Games. You can't sell the Hunger Games like that, right? You can't sell that to people. Why would they buy into it? They'd never buy into it. But the only way this stuff happens is voluntarily, and that's why I'm so grateful for the veterans, so grateful for our Constitution, and all the things that we have, some core values as a nation, that if we'll get back to that, I think we can make a huge difference, because it says that the what we have, that's the correct narrative. That correct narrative says that our rights weren't given to us by the government. If the government gives us rights and privileges, well, then
take it away.
They can take them away. But if we got them from God, that's the only way any free nation around the world was able to do it. And we were the model. America was the model. And they're telling us right now that if we don't maintain that model, guys, what's going to happen? We don't have anybody coming to the rescue for the United States of America. Now,
Christine is very polite, and we three are in the studio, so Christine, don't hesitate to butt right into the conversation. We don't want to certainly put you out of it.
Christine, let me ask you a question, because I hope I'm not stepping on a thought that you have. I hope I'm adding to it. My question for you is, as we talk about this change of mindset, you know, it's in the school district, it's in the society, it's in our culture. Susan alluded to the fact that we have these opportunities to count on our veterans and their worldviews and their opinions and their values. And yet, every day we see something new in the news that I served until 93. I got out of the Air Force in 93. This is not the same military I served in. It's an entirely different world. Would you agree with that?
Oh, 100%. 100%. You know, and I'll tell you, within the veteran community, there are a lot of really pissed off veterans, to be frank. We're really tired of seeing what's happening to our military. We are not battle ready by any stretch of the imagination. And do not misunderstand that there are people still within the military working within the system to fight this and combat this as well. But they're having to do it in a way that is not as confrontational as, say, maybe an article I would write or an article one of my veterans would write. just because they're still within the confines of that military structure. Now, but I will say, you know, veterans, you know, everybody kind of puts us in this group thing, and we're not. We're so very different, and we all have such, you know, we're all kind of like onions. You know, there's so many layers to each one of us, and we don't all think exactly alike, but there is one thing that binds us together, and that is our oath. Regardless of what branch we served, what era we served in, our oath is first and foremost to the Constitution of the United States and those amendments therein. And so, you know, I can see a lot of veterans, they're really frustrated right now. And they're at the point where it's like, you know, I'm not asking permission anymore. I'm just going to do it. It's kind of a common theme. Maybe not the Air Force, give me a little word in there. But, you know, in the military, a lot of times you do what needs to be done and ask forgiveness as opposed to asking for permission. And that's how we get things done. So I really see that mindset among a lot in the veteran community.
Yeah, it really is amazing to me. But, you know, the attack of the narrative, it's not just the training processes that we see in the military. It's not just the education that we see in our school districts. It's not just the city planning that we see at the city council. It's on so many different levels. It is the way that parents talk to their children and children talk to their parents. That's the way that our DAs, who many of them would have not been in office had it not been for a huge financial boon from somebody who has, well, a narrative of their own. And if we ignore all those things, all of the ways, the 30-front attack, the 30-level war that we're fighting, if we ignore all of those things, we will find ourselves victim to a narrative that was not ours to craft. It was not ours to write. It's just ours to live by. On Lead the Narrative, I want you to back up for a moment from where you are and ask yourself the question of all the things that I've heard today, which ones are true? Which ones demand of me an action? Now realize, like the man who subdued the violent criminal on the subway and is now facing a long time in prison, the one who took the gun away from a man who shot him several times and shot back, also was arrested while in the hospital. The one who defended himself as they broke into his shop and tried to destroy his retail shop. Not good things. The law is not always on our side, but righteousness is. I want you to take the time to ask which ones of those things are true and which ones are most important to you. What should you do about it? What could you do about it? But the first thing that you got to do is you got to start telling the stories of the truth that you've lived through, the experiences you've had when this was your kind of America. I'm J. Lauren Norris with Lead the Narrative for Tell It Like It Is TV. Have a blessed day.